This is a speech by Elizabeth May given at the UBC Robson Center in Vancouver on June 6, 2006 and sponsored by the BC Sustainable Energy Association. In part one of the speech, Elizabeth May outlines the vision and the failures in Canada's race to control carbon emissions. In part two, Elizabeth May takes on the new giant of carbon emissions in Canada, namely the Athabasca tar sands in Alberta.
One of the really most confusing pieces of data that's thrown about, and it'll take up a lot of the rest of what I want to talk about, is this notion that somehow the U.S. has done better than Canada without having ratified Kyoto. I don't know how many of you have heard this. The U.S. has done better than we have because their emissions have risen since 1990 by 16%, and our emissions have risen by almost 25%, and therefore the U.S. did better at reducing emissions. Well, number one, of course, the fact that the U.S. emissions have risen by 16% above 1990 levels does not suggest they're actually doing anything to reduce emissions. In fact, their emissions, as I mentioned earlier, they're 25% of the world's emissions. Canada is 3% of world's emissions. So while there is no excuse for us not meeting our Kyoto target, neither is it really comparable that when the U.S. emissions go up by 16%, that's over a billion tons of greenhouse gases because it's such a large component. They're still the world's biggest polluter. No matter how much we look at the fact that China and India are creeping up on them, the U.S. is still the world's biggest polluter, and their emissions have gone up 16% since 1990. Now, Canadian emissions have risen as well, and largely because the government of Canada, particularly under Jean Chrétien, 1993, he hadn't been at Rio, but he showed up with a Red Book commitment that was so much better than anything Mulroney promised that I really believed they'd be better. And the Red Book commitment in 1993 committed Canada, if the Liberals were to come to power, with a 20% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. Now, I'm sorry for this, but it's a different base year. They promised a 20% emissions reductions against 1988 levels to be achieved by 2005. And as you know, by 2005, we'd gone up by about 25%. So clearly not a target that they reached. It's hard to hit a target when you don't aim at it. And that was Mr. Chrétien's biggest problem, was that he went on to then, within a few months of becoming prime minister, go to Alberta and promise that the tar sands would receive federal help for development. And that's been the biggest problem. The difference between the 16% rise in the U.S., and the 25% rise in Canada, just looking at it by percentages and not by tons, is the Athabasca tar sands. They were not up and running and functioning the way they do now in 1990, and that's why I say it's the big carbon elephant in the room. Way back in the early days of the tar sands in the 1970s, there wasn't much going on. Syncrude had federal government ownership, Alberta government ownership. It was the biggest player in the oil sands, tar sands, and it wasn't doing very much. Now, granted, and a lot of you know about the concern with the end of oil, that the cheap and available oil is running out on this planet, no question. So that means that something that was completely uncommercial and never considered part of global oil reserves became attractive. So when we talk about the tar sands, the first thing I need you to get into your mind, if you can visualize it, I don't know, the name is not very descriptive of the ecosystem. This is not a vast Canadian northern equivalent of the Sahara. This is boreal forest. These are rich, functioning ecosystems, large carbon sinks of boreal forest, muskeg, wetland, migratory bird habitat, caribou habitat. This is pristine forest, or at least it used to be. That's what is just under, if you're prepared to strip away all the boreal forest and dig, you find this kind of oily substance. It is the tar sands are by percentage about 85% clay, sand, and rock, and about 10% this viscous oily substance called bitumen. It can be described as tarry, it can be described as like molasses. One thing it isn't is cheap and easy to get. So you have to be pretty desperate for oil to decide that this is a good place to go look for it. But now they're realizing that it's technically feasible to get at an estimated 280 to 300 billion barrels of crude that's locked up, so inconvenient for the industry, locked up under boreal forests and tons of rock and sand and sediment and muskeg and so on. This volume of crude, now that it's entered global reserves, as though it is because it's technically feasible to go get it, is more than the reserves of Saudi Arabia. And by the way, Canada is already exporting more oil and gas to the U.S. than Saudi Arabia. So we go from the broken Red Book commitment to the Athabasca tar sands in the early 90s. Now, I should mention that back in the 1970s, when Peter Lougheed was premier of Alberta, he was premier from 71 to 85, and one of the things that he felt was that someday there would be a big boom in the tar sands, and not because he cared about ecology, I don't think that was a driver at all, but he did feel there should be a sort of orderly development. So they created someone who was in charge, they called them the Northeast Commissioner for Oil Development, and Peter Lougheed has been quoted as saying, we called him the Tsar, and the idea was that things would become orderly in the way they went forward. Now, in addition to the Earth Summit happening 14 years ago in 1992, another global ecological event happened, but it wasn't a good one. It was the election of Ralph Klein as Premier of Alberta. One of the first things that Ralph Klein did, because he liked market forces even more than Peter Lougheed, he decided to get rid of the Tsar thing. They didn't think they needed that. And by 1996, Klein looked at the fact that the tar sands weren't developing fast enough, and oil prices were still less than $20 US a barrel. So Ralph Klein lowered the royalties for tar sands development to 1% until companies recovered all their capital costs. Then after cost recovery, it would rise to 25%. This constituted a huge giveaway. According to the Globe and Mail report on business, 1% is one of the lowest oil royalty rates on the planet. So before 1996, Suncor had been paying 30% less its costs on the oil, and suddenly it's paying 1%. And then when it starts making money, it's allowed to be charged 25%. By comparison, Venezuela's royalty rates for conventional oil, about 30%. Norway, with not having to get it out of bitumen crude, Norway charges about $14 a barrel, whereas in Alberta it's coming out now to about $4 a barrel. So this is a nice corporate giveaway item. And right now we're watching this mount, but what else is going on? We know the provincial government has made it easy for the oil and gas industry with very low royalty rates. In 1993, I mentioned that Chrétien promised the tar sands money. It was a very, very pivotal trip that Chrétien took to Edmonton. I don't know how many of you follow politics closely enough to remember that one of the only Liberals elected in Alberta was Anne McClellan in Edmonton. She was dubbed Landslide Annie because she won by 17 votes. Chrétien flew out to Edmonton and did two key things. One was he announced $3 billion as a giveaway to get the tar sands development going. And the other was, now that we'd signed the Framework Convention on Climate Change and ratified it, there was an ongoing, as always in Canada, multi-stakeholder process involving federal government, provincial governments, and interested stakeholders, including the environmental movement, to examine what measures would work to reduce emissions. And there were 80 measures that were being analyzed through the federal system with provincial governments and others. One of those measures was a carbon tax. So when Chrétien went to the tar sands, he also announced Canada would not even consider a carbon tax, and it was removed from being a subject for study. We never could even analyze what its economic and ecological impacts would be. But that wasn't enough. So in 1996, the federal government did more to subsidize the tar sands boom. In 1996, the federal government created an accelerated capital cost allowance for companies operating in the tar sands that they could deduct up to 100% of the cost of their equipment against their first year's income. That comes to about $1 billion a year in direct subsidies. Chrétien further shielded the tar sands, by the way, from Kyoto implementation. Just on the eve of ratification in Kyoto in 2002, Chrétien promised any tar sands companies that if in the course of limiting their emissions, it should ever cost more than $15 a ton to reduce emissions, the difference would be made up by the Canadian taxpayer, And he also promised that emission reductions targets for the industry would be different from emission reductions targets in the rest of the plan and would adopt the George Bush approach, which is called an intensity target, which means instead of saying you shall reduce your emissions by half, say you shall reduce your emissions by, I mean, half I just picked out of thin air, by any amount, you should reduce your emissions by half as an actual figure is worth having. You should reduce your emissions by half by as a measure of every unit of production depends on how your unit of productions are going up. So an intensity target is all about reductions per barrel of oil. So what's happening to the barrels of oil? Well, in about 1970, rather 1995, they were up to about a half a million barrels of oil a day produced in the tar sands. They went from a half a million barrels of oil a day in 1995. By 2000, were up to a million barrels a day. And by 2011, it's anticipated it will go to 2 million barrels of oil a day. And then it's projected to rise from there. We are now responsible for 16% of all the oil that the United States imports, and most of it is from the tar sands. So that, again, is just extraordinary exponential growth in what we're selling. But here's the irony. Why are we subsidizing the wealthiest corporations in the world to sell dirty crude to the United States cheaply to burn in SUVs in a country that isn't committed to any Kyoto targets at all? Now, that's the economics of it. What are the ecological impacts of the tar sands development? And they are many. Actually, before I get to the ecological impacts, I want to tell you something about what's happened to Fort McMurray. Many people will assume that the streets of Fort McMurray must be paved with gold by now. Reality is Fort McMurray is not a happy place because the tar sands boom is causing unbearable social pressures. The population of Fort McMurray has gone from, in 1971, just under 7,000 people. By 1981, over 30,000. And today, 70,000 people live in Fort McMurray. 20% of them have no fixed address. The housing crisis is acute. They are expecting 8% year growth to continue. It's been 8% a year since 1998 and no sign of stopping. There's an acute lack of workers for the tar sands. It's so significant that it's anticipated that by 2007, that all of the province of Alberta, so this isn't Fort McMurray alone, but the entire province of Alberta, will rely on 20,000 temporary foreign workers. The Canadian Resources Horizon Mine, and this is an environmental assessment where I appeared on behalf of Sierra Club of Canada as the only intervener against getting a permit because of the climate impacts. The Canadian Resources Horizon Mine this year brought in 200 temporary workers from China. And meanwhile, there's an Edmonton construction company that's figured out how to solve the acute lack of workers by hiring prisoners who are entitled to day passes. It has some of the highest crime rates anywhere in Canada. It has very, very significant drug problems because you've got workers. In order to hang on to workers, they are paid a small fortune. I mean, the wages in Fort McMurray are so distorting that at this point, in order to be to qualify for low-income housing in Fort McMurray, the poverty line is for anyone earning less than $65,000 a year. It has an acute healthcare crisis. There are two doctors for every 6,500 people. I've spoken to the doctors in Fort McMurray, and they talk about how they've seen every kind of high-risk behavior you can imagine inside the work camps with these guys who are being paid a fortune and have no place to spend their money. So prostitution, drugs, violent crime, HIV, AIDS, everything is going on in these work camps. But the disaster to society represented by the tar sands extends beyond Fort McMurray, of course. The toxic contaminants released from tar sands operations are the most likely culprit in a recent cancer spike in the Cree population of Fort Chipewyan. Air quality is profoundly bad. I've talked to many people in Fort McMurray who tell you they know when Syncrude is venting the pipes because that's when their kids get asthma attacks. and water quality is significantly at risk. The amount of water that Fort McMurray, rather, that the tar sands operations consume is mind-boggling, because producing, going from this bitumen crud into usable crude takes profligate amounts of two things that we really can't afford to waste: energy and water. The province of Alberta, unlike the province of Ontario, charges virtually nothing for access to water, and the Department of Environment for Alberta does not factor into the water licenses they are granting for pulling water out of the Athabasca River for the impact of climate change and the fact the Athabasca River flow is already declining. So they've already committed, companies in the Athabasca tar sands region already have legal rights to take water from the Athabasca River equivalent to all the water use by the city of Calgary in a year times two. It's vast quantities of water. For every barrel of oil produced, it's somewhere between 4 to 6 barrels of water that are consumed. Now, of course, the water doesn't come out very pretty at the other end. So there are large tailings ponds to hold the contaminated water while it settles. The tailings ponds, I mean, everything about the Fort McMurray tar sands operations is spelled out in gargantuan letters. This is just the first of the stats I'm going to give you, give a sense of scale. The tar sands tailings ponds, think of tailings ponds, ponds automatically sound sort of small. They should call them the tailings oceans. People would then get the picture. The tailings ponds at the tar sands already occupy an area equivalent to 50 square kilometers. And the dams that hold in that tar sands tailing pond area are some of the largest man-made structures on Earth. This is all stuff that's visible from outer space now. Now, to get the bitumen crude out of the ground, first of all, as I mentioned, you have to remove all the forest. So you destroy the entire surface layer of life. You remove the forest, you destroy the muskeg, and you start digging. Now, they're prepared to dig for any bitumen crude that as much as 75 meters below the Earth's surface. They'll dig down as much as 75 meters. Below that, they don't give up and go away. No, no, no. They have what they call in situ mining, which involves pumping either steam water or cool water or saline water to attempt to move the bitumen crude up towards the surface. So they have a very sophisticated, very water-intensive in situ mining as well as the strip mining. 75 meter down, they're prepared to dig away at the earth in one of the world's largest strip mining operations. The trucks that do this work, you talk to men who work in that work, you know, you're basically walking up two flights to get to the front door of your truck. And then you get to work and you dig up the bitumen and you put it into large trucks and you ship it in from this open pit mine. And each mine takes up thousands of hectares. These are not small mines. So they dig it all up and they take it to be refined into crude. And you're using a lot of water, but you also have to use a lot of energy. So the energy equivalent for a barrel of oil produced from the Athabasca tar sands is the equivalent to 1/3 to 1/2 a barrel. Okay, now you can see, where are they going to get all the energy to keep running these operations in northern Alberta? That's what the Mackenzie Gas Pipeline is for. They're going to build gas platforms at the mouth of the Mackenzie River at the Beaufort Sea. 2 out of 3, by the way, are in bird sanctuaries. Then they're going to run a 1,300-kilometer-long pipeline under the surface. So it's a subsurface pipeline through inconsistent permafrost, which, due to the impacts of the climate crisis, much of this permafrost is already melting, particularly far north near the mouth of the river. This is an engineering nightmare. But the end point of all of this movement of natural gas is another pipeline that brings it into the Athabasca tar sands. Now, natural gas is also in short supply globally. Natural gas is not a perfect fuel. Certainly getting it out of the Beaufort Sea, digging it up, and putting it through that pipeline is a significant ecological disaster. The Mackenzie Valley is 1/6, the whole watershed is 1/6 the landmass of Canada, and is one of our last untouched wildernesses. This will industrialize that entire area. There's a lot wrong with the Mackenzie gas pipeline. But one might be able to say, well, I guess we really need that natural gas because, after all, we won't want to go to coal. We could use that natural gas to run electricity generation. But the reality is, most of the Mackenzie gas, if not all, is going to go to the Athabasca tar sands to turn that bitumen crud into crude to be sold to the U.S. It's been described, the process of taking clean, relatively clean-burning natural gas and turning it into Athabasca tar sands crude has been described as a process of turning gold into lead. It's quite extraordinary. Now, even if we used all the gas from the Beaufort Sea for the Athabasca tar sands, it's still probably not enough energy. So recently, Ralph Klein decided nuclear reactors wouldn't be too bad in the Athabasca tar sands region. And the government of Saskatchewan under Lauren Calvert is seriously considering a nuclear reactor at northwestern Saskatchewan to sell electricity to the Athabasca tar sands operations. And there's a French investor who wants to get into the Athabasca tar sands, promises they'll build their own reactor if they're allowed to get in. It's quite extraordinary. So when you take all this together, we've got massive destruction of boreal forest, migratory bird habitat, caribou habitat, wetlands, muskeg, and, of course, the carbon sequestration that all of that area represented in holding carbon out of the atmosphere. You've got this huge impact on the quantity of available water in a region where, as Dr. David Schindler, one of Canada's leading scientists, who's a scientist at the University of Alberta, Edmonton, is warning, Alberta is heading for a water crisis. The glaciers are all in retreat. The snowpack isn't the same. Farmers, ranchers, groundwater are going to be in short supply. And meanwhile, the greediest water consumer in the province is the Athabasca tar sands, and they show no sign of understanding that they can't have what they want. And we have the greenhouse gas impact. Told you in general terms how large it is. Here's to get a picture of where it's going. I mentioned that by 2011, they expect to have doubled it to 2 million barrels a day of oil produced. By that time, it's anticipated that the greenhouse gas emissions from those operations alone, not including when you burn that oil running in somebody's car in the States, but the greenhouse gas emissions from the upstream costs of producing the oil will be the equivalent to, and this is a low-end figure, by the way, 70 million tons of CO2 every year. Now, 70 megatons, or 70 million tons, is a huge chunk of the gap that Canada has to meet to get to our Kyoto target. In fact, our total Kyoto gap is 280 megatons. So 70 megatons is a rather large contribution to our overall gap. And that's the reason that U.S. emissions, as a percentage, I mean, as I said, in tonnage, there's no question, U.S. emissions far outstripped Canadian. But as a percentage matter, the difference between U.S. emissions increases and Canadian emissions increases is us feeding the U.S. addiction for fossil fuels by selling them the dirtiest carbon crude on the face of the earth, subsidized by the Canadian taxpayer, and subsidized by the people of Alberta who are giving away the oil at bargain basement royalties. So what can we do about this? Well, I think the first thing that's really critical is to inform ourselves. This is not just a matter of Alberta on its own making decisions about its energy. No doubt some of you have heard Ralph Klein sounding very suspicious that all Canada is looking at the wealth of Alberta and planning to pounce on it and steal it, so that we can live our slovenly, lazy ways, unlike Albertans. I mean, it's so outrageous. The thing that is extraordinary about this is Ralph Klein's rhetoric never takes into account the fact that he wouldn't have the Athabasca tar sands producing a million barrels of oil a day if the federal government hadn't been so extraordinarily generous to the tar sands industry. And when the federal government gives very advantageous accelerated capital cost allowances and grants and all of that, that's taxpayers. We hear a lot about, from parts of society, about we don't like subsidies for mass transit or we don't want subsidies for daycare. But no, I don't hear a lot of people in Mr. Harper's cabinet complaining about the corporate welfare bums running the Athabasca tar sands. The wealthiest corporations in the world are getting some of the most preferential tax treatment for a product that is the world's most profitable product, to which people are addicted. You really don't need to subsidize the production of oil and gas. As a U.S. Congressman Markey, commenting on this in U.S. hearings on the subsidies that the Bush administration gives oil and gas, he said, you know, subsidizing the oil and gas industry is like subsidizing a fish to swim. You don't need to do it. Oil is $70 a barrel, and they are making a killing, a literal killing. So first phase is understand what this is about and begin to at least say, we're not trying to steal anything from Alberta, but we think that the oil and gas companies should, at a very, very minimum, pay the full cost of what they're doing. They should pay for the water they're taking out of the Athabasca River, which currently they take for free. They should pay the full costs to the tax system of what they're doing. Why should oil and gas companies get an accelerated capital cost allowance that people developing a cogeneration plant can't get? And we should have a moratorium. A lot of permits have already been given that take us to 2 million barrels of oil a day, but they're lining up. As a matter of fact, they're falling over each other to get in the tar sands. It's so significant that Peter Lougheed, again, I'll quote him, without his czar, he bemoans the fact that it's actually hurting the economy of Alberta, that there's such a complete chaos of development going on. Lougheed calls it the traffic jam. They all want to get at everything there is as fast as they can. And nobody's in control. Nobody's really regulating. And God knows the Ministry of the Department of Environment for Alberta allows emissions levels from these facilities that are dangerous to local people. So a moratorium on any new projects, reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the tar sands immediately. A lot of discussion going on about whether tar sands development could be carbon neutral. The first step is to make sure there's no new development for long enough to take stock of greenhouse gas emissions, impact on wetlands, impact on water, and local pollution, and make the industry pay the cost of its operations. Then it's critical that having slowed down our worst problem in Canada, we look at how we meet our Kyoto targets in the first commitment period till 2012, and how we meet the real target beyond 2012, which by 2020, to avoid tipping points in the global atmosphere that will affect global climate in ways that are irreversible, we need to reduce emissions by 30% below 1990 levels by 2020. We really don't have time for any more mistakes. We don't have time for any more nonsense from governments. And by 2030, by 2050, the ultimate target by 2050 is now about 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. And if you can't imagine a government brave enough to announce that they're committed to 80% below 1990 levels by 2050, then imagine a Republican governor for the United States, the Terminator, Arnold Schwarzenegger. That's his target. 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. And California has the toughest vehicle regulations anywhere in North America. And, of course, the big three auto companies are in there in court trying to stop them. The California assemblywoman who got the law passed through the California legislature to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the automobile fleet by 25%, her name is Fran Pavley, she said, I just wish these car companies would put away their lawyers and get out their engineers. But they show up and they fight everything. But there are progressive jurisdictions, and Canada could be one of them. But we first have to face the big problem that we can't have our cake and eat it too. We can't claim to be, as the Liberals did in the past, a Kyoto-compliant nation while hoping nobody notices that we're subsidizing the tar sands and selling it to the United States. We also can't be a responsible nation by pretending that we're going to do something called a Made in Canada plan that might happen someday when we're really all about destroying global progress by being an anti-Kyoto country hiding inside the Kyoto Protocol. So these things require a lot of public engagement, a lot of participation, and I would urge all of you to help. Now, there are a couple things you can do. There's certainly supporting the British Columbia Sustainable Energy Association, and there's also a terrific program that I wanted to bring to your attention that's been launched by the City of Vancouver called the One Day Program. Vivian, you want to stand up for just a sec? I want you to see Vivian with the City of Vancouver program One Day, and she's got a nice little clipboard, really easy. You can sign up, and these are great efforts that you can take to be a positive player in reducing greenhouse gases here in Vancouver. The cities, by the way, God bless the cities of Canada. They had the Federation of Canadian Municipalities meeting recently in Montreal, and they issued a consensus declaration to Mr. Harper to say, you can't walk away from Kyoto, we won't let you, we'll still meet our targets. By the way, in the United States, started by Mayor Greg Nickels of Seattle, just when the Kyoto Protocol came into legal effect, February 16th, 2005, Mayor Greg Nickels thought, Seattle should commit to the Kyoto targets. Who cares if George Bush doesn't? Seattle will commit, and I'll challenge other mayors to do the same. And he had collected over 100 cities by July when he announced his program. And I'll never forget one of the cities that I thought was so impressive. There was a mayor who signed that statement. Of course, I didn't read it in the Canadian press. I hate to tell you, I read it in The Guardian. But a U.S. mayor who said, why is it George Bush is president? We all admire the fact that he didn't wait to find out if Saddam Hussein was really dangerous. He could see the threat and he took action. How come he doesn't see the threat of climate change and respond in the same way? And this mayor who made this clever analogy went on to say, my city's probably the most vulnerable city anywhere in the United States of America, the most vulnerable city to the threat of global warming. And that mayor was Ray Nagin, mayor of New Orleans. He saw the light a little too late, and it's a terrible tragedy. But just before the climate change conference started in November in Montreal, the 200th U.S. mayor had signed on. So 200 U.S. mayors committed to Kyoto, the Federation of Canadian Municipalities committed to Kyoto, all the New England governors, in combination with the Eastern Canadian premiers, have a regional Kyoto target. We've got California, we've got U.S. congressmen and senators. Increasingly, George Bush has no one he can count on anymore except for Stephen Harper. So we really need to face the climate crisis at the level of the science, the personal actions we all can take, and the politics of where does Canada stand in the world. And it also means that without being unfriendly, because frankly, the people of Alberta are more at risk from the impacts of climate change than almost any other Canadians, because the water crisis that's heading for them will be far worse than anything that happened in the Dust Bowl. And there are a lot of Albertans who don't get their bread and butter from oil and gas. They're ranchers and they're farmers and they're in tourism and they're in deep, deep trouble. And their government doesn't give a damn because there's not a Made in Canada plan coming down the pipe. It's a Made in Houston plan. And if it leaves the people of Alberta behind in poverty once the boom is gone, they don't care. So this is not a hostile towards Alberta speech I'm giving you. This is a we can't let the fossil fuels of northern Alberta be consumed at this rate with this level of ecological damage by a bunch of bandits masquerading as a premier and a prime minister. So I'm asking for your help to spread the word that Kyoto is not dead, that other countries are moving forward, and that for Canada to do its part, we have to stop the expansion of the Athabasca tar sands and look at the environmental damage and the social threats and all the issues in Fort McMurray and act in a positive way to create a sustainable future for that region, that province, and all of Canada. Thank you very much.
That concludes part two of a speech given by Elizabeth May on June 6, 2006 in Vancouver. It was sponsored by the BC Sustainable Energy Association and recorded by Radio EcoShock at www.ecoshock.org.